From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
We'll take a uniquely Florida look at the Republican National Convention that wrapped up last night.
What they want is good jobs and lower prices. They want borders that are secure and for those who come here to do so legally.
Also this week, we'll examine why the GOP presidential nominee picked a relative unknown for his running mate.
J.D. Vance will be able to spend lots of campaign time in those Midwestern states.
We'll also find that a right to hunt and fish is teed up for a constitutional amendment vote in Florida, and discover why so many of the state's art organizations are tightening their belts. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida Republicans are rallying behind former President Donald Trump as he looks to regain the White House in the upcoming presidential election. Adrian Andrews has a recap on what some of the Sunshine State's leaders said this past week at the Republican National Convention.
Thousands of Republicans from across the U.S. packed into a Pfizer Forum in Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention. The event lasted 4 days, but by day one, Trump had already announced J.D. Vance as his running mate. The 39-year-old Ohio senator will become the next vice president if Trump wins. Florida Senator Marco Rubio had been a potential contender for the job. During a speech at the convention, he offered his support for both Vance and Trump.
The only way to make America wealthy and safe and strong again is to make Donald J. Trump our president again.
Rubio, a descendant of Cuban immigrants, has represented Florida in the United States Senate since 2011. He says Trump supporters are regular people who just want to live a better life.
It is not hateful or extreme. What they want is good jobs and lower prices. They want borders that are secure and for those who come here to do so legally.
The Republican convention kicked off just 2 days after Trump was the target in a failed assassination attempt at a Pennsylvania rally. Trump survived the attack but sustained minor injuries to his right ear. A former fire chief was shot and killed during the same attack. He was a Trump supporter and was attending the rally with his family. During the convention, Rubio remembered Cory Compratore.
Last Saturday, he shielded his wife and daughter from an assassin's bullet and lost his life the way he lived it, a hero.
As Rubio took his seat, the theme shifted to the safety of Americans and the ongoing wars overseas. Former state governor and current Florida U.S. Senator Rick Scott says if the Biden administration wins again, he worries there will be less protection in place at the U.S.-Mexico border. He also believes the U.S. will be at war with other countries, and he worries the Biden administration could open the door to non-U.S. citizens voting in federal elections. That's currently prevented by federal law, but the subject has become a Republican talking point. Here's Scott.
Biden and the Democrats are doing everything they can to tear down this great country and rebuild it in their woke radical image.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis echoed Scott's thoughts about needing stricter border protections, something the governor has urged for the past 5 years. But at the convention, DeSantis put more emphasis on the U.S. military. In his 8-minute speech, the governor bashed the Biden administration, pointing to a deadly 2021 suicidal bombing in Afghanistan that killed 13 U.S. troops. DeSantis blames Biden for not handling the issue with terrorists and calls the August 30th U.S.-Afghan withdrawal mission a humiliating experience.
13 of our service members were killed in Afghanistan due to Joe Biden's dereliction of duty.
The Biden cracks continued, with DeSantis pointing to Biden's lackluster debate performance and labeling Biden's presidency as a
weekend at Bernie's presidency.
DeSantis went on insinuating that Biden may be too old for another term. despite Trump and Biden being just 3 years apart in age. DeSantis, who earlier this year hoped to best Trump in the race for Republican nominee, said he and the rest of the Republicans in Florida are voting for Trump to rebuild the economy, stop diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in schools, and to keep undocumented immigrants out of the country.
The left is in retreat. Freedom reigns supreme. The woke mind virus is dead, and Florida is a solid Republican state.
Democrats will be responding to Republicans next month in Chicago as Joe Biden officially takes the Democratic nomination. The Democratic National Convention will run from August 19th through August 22nd. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Florida's U.S. Senator Marco Rubio was passed over as former President Donald Trump's VP pick. Tristan Wood reports political watchers are saying Trump picking J.D. Vance doesn't spell the end of Rubio's political aspirations, but some believe the move could hurt another prominent Florida Republican.
There were plenty of downsides to Rubio being Trump's VP pick. Both men calling Florida home would have been a violation of the Constitution, meaning one of them would have had to establish residency in another state. Additionally, Rubio's strength in Florida would have offered little to Trump electorally, as the former president is currently leading Biden in the polls in the Sunshine State by more than 8 points. Justin Safey, a Republican lobbyist who attended the RNC, says the selection of Vance is not a snub on Rubio, but due to the strength of Vance as an option. He says Vance's youth and strength in the Midwest was likely the difference maker.
The presidency will be decided in the states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So J.D. Vance will be able to spend lots of campaign time in those Midwestern states. And if Trump-Vance ticket is able to win one or more of those states, they will win the White House.
But just because Rubio wasn't selected for VP doesn't mean he won't have a role in a potential Trump administration. Susan McManus, a political analyst and convention attendee, says conversations in Milwaukee are focused on how Rubio makes sense in a foreign policy role in the next Republican White House because of his extensive experience in that area in Congress.
The common thought here is that he may be offered Secretary of State for his foreign policy knowledge. It would be good for the Republicans to have someone that better understands South America, which is now becoming a big ground for Chinese and Iranians and other groups moving in there.
Rubio himself seems to have taken the decision in stride. Hours after Trump announced his selection, Rubio sent out a fundraising email supporting the Trump-Vance ticket. UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett says that move is likely to stay in Trump's good graces.
I think Rubio, wants to make sure that Trump and the Trump team knows that he holds no hard feelings and he still wants them to win. And that by doing that, it helps keep him more viable, not only for a spot in the administration, but in the future more viable for a run for president, should Rubio choose to do that again.
Jewett doesn't believe being passed over has hurt Rubio's political career. However, he does believe the elevation of Vance has constructed a roadblock in Governor Ron DeSantis' future higher office aspirations.
Because you get this young, very outspoken, Trump-loving guy who's who's totally converted to the MAGA movement, and he does not have the baggage of having challenged Trump.
Safey says Vance's selection as VP could give him the inside track in future Republican presidential primaries, as he can be viewed as Trump's pick for the successor to the MAGA movement.
Because of the fact that J.D. Vance is so young, because of the fact that Donald Trump is term limited to one term, it's possible that the two people on the current ticket will be on the future tickets of the Republican Party until 2036, which is pretty remarkable.
Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried agrees. She views Trump's selection of Vance as the anointing of who the former president wants to lead Republicans. She's glad it isn't DeSantis.
His political future is over. He has no path. You know, that the people across this country rejected the MAGA extremism. They rejected the six-week abortion ban. They rejected the all-out assault on our education and book banning. And so now that Trump has given the nod to JD that he is going to be MAGA 2.0, I truly don't know where Ron goes from here. And quite honestly, on behalf of myself as a Floridian, it couldn't happen to a nicer person.
I'm Tristan Wood.
Better mark your calendar. Voters in Florida face a Monday, July 22nd deadline to register to vote in next month's primary election. The August 20th ballot will include partisan primary races for the U.S. Senate and some congressional and legislative races. There are also several nonpartisan city, county, and judicial races across the state open to all voters, regardless of political affiliation. In addition to new Florida voters, those who wish to switch their political party affiliation must also make changes by Monday for the update to take effect. Here's Mark Early. He's the supervisor of elections in Leon County.
We have quite a few races that will be decided in this primary, so that if you wait and vote in November only, thinking that that's the big election, you won't get a chance to vote in some of these city commission or county commission or school board races.
As of June 30th, there were more than 13.4 million registered voters in the state of Florida. Coming up on Capitol Report, hunting and fishing rights will be on the ballot in November.
It's also the preferred method of wildlife management. And frankly, that blindsided a lot of the wildlife and animal welfare groups.
Arts organizations all over Florida are scrambling to stay afloat after a wholesale veto of state grant funding.
It's really affected us for the entire year for all of our programming, not just our free festival that we do for our community.
And a changing of the guard is coming to Florida A&M University as President Larry Robinson prepares to step down.
He put the place back on the land of stability, on the path to progress, and the place made great progress.
Outdoor enthusiasts and wildlife conservationists may be interested in a proposal going on the November ballot. Voters will see it as proposed Constitutional Amendment 2, as Gina Jordan reports.
Amendment 2 is titled The Right to Fish and Hunt.
Members, this is a proposed amendment to the Florida Constitution to preserve hunting, fishing, and the taking of fish and wildlife, including the use of traditional methods in perpetuity as a public right, and that is the resolution.
Lake Mary Republican Senator Jason Broder helped sponsor what became a House joint resolution. It was approved by both chambers during last year's legislative session with a single no vote. Florida statutes already allow fishing and hunting, so Naples Republican Representative Lauren Mello explained an amendment is needed because several states are making moves to ban these activities.
Due to that, we feel that we would like to get ahead and make sure that we preserve the right. There are 23 other states that have already passed this.
Mello added that Florida is the only southeastern state not to make this change. Here's the thing. No state has outlawed these activities. An initiative attempted in Oregon did not qualify for this year's ballot. The vote yes on Amendment 2 political committee has raised over $700,000 for the proposal that it says will preserve Florida's rich traditions while providing the fundamentals of conservation. But some of the ballot language is raising red flags.
It establishes as the preferred method of wildlife management, hunting and fishing. And frankly, that's an outrageous position to take because no legitimate wildlife biologist would tell you that the best way to manage wildlife is through killing it.
Ralph DiMeo is an attorney in Tallahassee and an adjunct professor of animal law. He also writes articles and serves as the editor for the Florida Bar Animal Law section.
If it was limited to simply putting in the Constitution the statutory protections that already exists for hunting and fishing, we would probably be okay with that. But the switch came when they added that provision that it's also the preferred method of wildlife management. And frankly, that blindsided a lot of the wildlife and animal welfare groups.
In addition, the amendment creates a protection for traditional methods of hunting and fishing without defining those methods. Opponents argue the vague language in the amendment could lead to litigation over what methods should be allowed. Chuck O'Neill chairs the No2.org political committee.
Constitutional scholars have looked at this language and have come to the conclusion that this right to hunt with traditional methods is in direct conflict with the 1994 gillnet ban. And what they say is that the more recent of the two constitutional measures is the governing measure.
Mike Elfenbein says the amendment would not reverse the constitutional net ban. He's executive director of the Cypress chapter of the Isaac Walton League of America, a conservation organization in Charlotte County.
Traditional means of hunting and fishing means those methods which are legal at the time that the constitutional amendment passes. So those things would be like archery equipment, black powder or muzzleloader equipment, general guns, which are rifles.
Elfenbein is a board member of the Future of Hunting in Florida, a nonprofit, and he says he was there as this resolution was being crafted.
The constitutional amendment doesn't give everybody carte blanche to do what they want. Everything has to be done within the bounds of the law and within the bounds of the process, and the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission remains the authority on that.
Elfenbein calls the amendment a grassroots effort by Floridians, and he says hunting and fishing have long been the preferred methods for wildlife management.
If you enjoy clean water and you enjoy green spaces and you want to know that the land that's out there has lots of little critters running around on it and that everything's healthy and doing well, you have to vote yes on Amendment 2.
This proposed constitutional amendment was placed on the November ballot by the Florida legislature. That means the proposal doesn't have to go to the Florida Supreme Court for a review of the ballot language, as other proposed amendments must do. Chuck O'Neill's opposition campaign has raised less than $4,000, but he's doing the best he can to promote his cause, and he says he hopes people understand what they're voting for.
We are definitely in a David versus Goliath fight on this measure. We're just asking for people to read the measure.
The amendment needs support from 60% of voters to pass. I'm Gina Jordan.
Hundreds of museums and arts organizations all over Florida are dealing with an unprecedented loss of state funding. It's the first time all of the grants approved by the Department of State's Division of Cultural Affairs have been vetoed out of existence. We spoke to several North Florida arts organizations. They say they're determined to survive nonetheless. Jennifer Jones heads the Florida Cultural Alliance. It's the statewide advocate for arts organizations. She says a wholesale elimination of these grants has never happened before.
Total of $32 million, but on two lines. Looking back, as far as we can look to find details, it had never happened that all of the grant funding had been vetoed.
Governor DeSantis said the veto was sparked by his disapproval of the Tampa and Orlando Fringe Festivals, which he called sexual events and not appropriate for state funding support. Festival organizers have since offered to return their state grants if the governor will restore money to the state's other arts organizations. So far, that hasn't happened. One of the impacted organizations is the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra. The grants it lost totaled more than $145,000. But Symphony Director Mandy Stringer says reserve funds and more community support have helped cushion the blow.
We have an action plan early in the ballgame, and this doesn't come out of left field and hit us at a time we're not expecting it.
But much smaller arts organizations, such as Gadsden Arts, a gallery in Quincy, has a bigger challenge, says Director Grace Robinson.
This is a big hit for us. Year to year, the funding level varies, but in terms of our small budget, it's between 7 and 12% of our budget.
But Robinson insists Gadsden Arts will survive even with the state funding loss.
Recognize we need to stick to the plan. It's working. We are engaging with many more people. We're growing as an organization. We're serving more children, youth, adult seniors. And then in return, more and more people are becoming part of the organization.
Over at the Southern Shakespeare Company, Executive Director Bianca Montague says program adjustments are underway.
It's really affected us for the entire year for all of our programming, not just our free festival that we do for our community, but our education programming that we do in the schools and in the community centers around town is going to be majorly affected by that as well.
Although Montague says for Southern Shakes, this show will go on, hopefully, with more help from friends and neighbors.
Unfortunately, it's become clear that we can't rely on our state government in the long run and that people in our community really need to come out and support their favorite arts organizations this year.
Mike Heron is executive director of the Monticello Opera House.
We offer access to the performing arts for a lot of people in Jefferson County, so it's important stuff. And I think it really makes a real contribution to the well-being and prosperity and even economic situation in Jefferson County.
He saw his legislative grant vanish and is eyeing some cutbacks in the venue's schedule to compensate.
It's going to really, you know, hurt our ability to do some shows to the point of we can't do the show because we just don't have the revenue there for it.
The arts organizations most fear that the elimination of the grants will be permanent. There are those who want to bring pressure to bear on lawmakers and the governor's office to reinstate the funding next year. Florida Cultural Alliance head Jennifer Jones is urging a more cautious approach.
We're going to up our game, you know, as far as creating visibility. It will all be very friendly and hopefully educational and inspirational in our presence on the Capitol. And maybe some more visibility in common areas. As far as other kinds of rallies that might appear as protests, we are not, as an organization, going to coordinate that.
Jones also hopes that all those who love the arts will contact lawmakers and urge them to restore the grants program. Florida's unemployment rate held steady in June for a third consecutive month as baby boomer retirements affect the size of the labor force and the hospitality industry has shed some jobs. The Florida Department of Commerce today released a report that said the state's June unemployment rate was 3.3%. That was unchanged from April and May. During the 3 months, the labor force of just over 11 million people actually lost 27,000 participants. Jimmy Heckman, the department's chief of workforce statistics and economic research, attributed the decrease in the workforce primarily to retirements, while saying workforce participation remains strong among people between the ages of 25 and 54. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, there will soon be a change in leadership for Florida's top-rated HBCU. The president of Florida A&M University is stepping down after a donor's large gift turned out to be an embarrassing misfire. But as Margie Menzel reports, many people, from students to state leaders, appreciate Larry Robinson's leadership of the university.
Before I came here, I heard many great stories about him, you know, how he built up the community even better than it was before.
That's FAMU student Khalil Ba. Fellow student Ben Joseph says he sometimes sees the president around campus.
When I do see him, he's always willing to, like, you know, wave, say hi, shake hands even, like make himself present, knowing that he's still with the students regardless of his position as university president.
But it's not just students who are saying these things in the wake of Robinson's resignation. Alan Levine, vice chair of the Florida Board of Governors, which oversees FAMU, called Robinson an incredible leader in a social media post. I am proud of his accomplishments while at FAMU, Levine wrote, including unprecedented student success, a top 100 ranking, number one ranking among public HBCUs, and the reduction in student debt. Robinson has served as president since 2017. The exact date of his departure will be determined in consultation with the Board of Trustees.
Dr. Robinson ought to be honored and celebrated for the difference he made.
That's former FAMU trustee David Lawrence Jr., chair of the Children's Movement of Florida and retired publisher of the Miami Herald.
He put the place back on the land of stability, on the path to progress, and the place made great progress and has gone through this significant and embarrassing bump.
During the past two decades, FAMU has cycled through presidents and bad financial audits, landed on accreditation probation due to a hazing scandal, and faced perennial problems in disbursing financial aid. But during Robinson's presidency, the academic qualifications of FAMU students accelerated. Robinson was proud of the high school GPA, 4.03, of last year's newly admitted class. But he acknowledged feeling a bit conflicted about it.
So Larry Robinson, back in the day, wouldn't be coming to FAMU. I'm really worried about what that means, because I worry about every student who comes and every student who doesn't get in, because that could be another person to help us as a nation, as a society, get to where we need to go. And of course, that student's family and their communities as well.
Former FAMU trustee Marjorie Turnbull, a retired Florida lawmaker, served on the school's board when Robinson was the provost.
One of his strengths that I saw was his recognition of encouraging and bringing in to top administrative positions women.
She says his inclusiveness extended to members of the faculty and staff.
That has not always been the case at FAMU and quite frankly, at other universities. I think in some ways universities were behind the curve on that. But clearly for him, he was looking for talent. And if he saw it in someone who happened to be a woman, he didn't think twice.
Turnbull says Robinson has been focused on bettering the academic experience for faculty and students.
I'm very sorry to see him go. I think he was a positive force at FAMU. I think he had an ability to bring people together. He was respected, highly respected in the community. And I think that it's going to be difficult to fill his shoes.
At FAMU's May 4th commencement ceremony, Robinson and Texas-based hemp investor Gregory Jerami announced that Jerami had donated $237 million to the school in the form of shares in his private company. The actual value of those shares is in question. That, along with Jerami's unsuccessful attempts to make large gifts to other institutions, has raised concerns. Robinson says it was his hope for the possibility of the gift that blinded him to what he says were warning signs that something was amiss. FAMU's board is now conducting an independent investigation into the university's processes for major gifts and vetting donors. They're also thinking about next steps for hiring a new leader. Former trustee Lawrence says everyone in FAMU's leadership ought to examine himself or herself and then go on and hire somebody who will take the place to the next level.
FAMU has huge pluses, but has some significant challenges, including how we doing on pass rates in various disciplines, including nursing and pharmacy, and a real challenge with the law school and a multiple set of deans.
Robinson didn't give a reason for his resignation in announcing it on July 12th. He plans to take a year's sabbatical before returning as a professor in FAMU's School of the Environment, a position he held before becoming president. I'm Marty Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.